your favourite equity accounting and the alternative approach of accounting for associates at fair value through profit and loss and what to do when actually one entity wants to do both. So Michael, over to you.
Thank you. Good morning, everyone. Bringing back an issue that we discussed at the February meeting regarding IAS 28 and the partial use of fair value through profit and loss when at the consolidated financial statement level there may be different holdings of the same ultimate associate through various purposes, and the application or the reading of paragraph 1 of IAS 28. The staff believes that two views, view A and view B, which are discussed in paragraph 6, can be read and interpreted through this. The staff has included four different examples to kind of help this presentation. And view A, I guess, looks at the unit of account as one investment in the associate at the consolidated level, so therefore all of the accounting policies are going to have to be applied to the entire holdings of that associate. View B looks at the management and intent and the original accounting policies that are applied at any lower level or in standalone financials, and that would survive through the consolidation process. Given the discussion that occurred at the March meeting and additional review, the staff believes that both views A and B could be supported and argued depending on your views at the unit of account level and other things, and therefore the staff believes that it's not going to be possible to draw an interpretation on this, but rather the staff's recommendation is that we propose this to the board for their consideration and possible inclusion of a paragraph or some information to clarify how it should be read.
Well, we know what Gilbert's comment on this would be. So we'll wait until later. Bruce?
I agree with the decision to refer it to the board, but I think we need to raise I don't know if we have time to discuss it today or what needs to be considered in the board's deliberations. I think there's an important point that the paper didn't address, which is if you have a look at the examples and compare, for example, A1 with example A2. In example A1, and just looking at subsidiary A already has significant influence over the investee fee, and therefore it is eligible for the scope exemption in IAS 28, para 1 of IAS 28, because it has an investment in an associate. So therefore it is eligible for the scope exclusion, and therefore you could argue, can't remember which view A or view B of the paper, but you could argue that it could measure its fair value to P&L, and that could carry up on consolidation. But if you have a look at example A2, in that situation, subsidiary A doesn't have an investment in an associate in the first place. It doesn't have significant influence. So therefore, it's not eligible for the scope exemption under Para 1 of IAS 28. And to me, that we haven't addressed that in the paper, and I think we do have to look at the separate issues of what do you look at first? Do you first look at whether or not you have significant influence, and do you add everything up to figure that out? But to me, it's a clearly different situation. In A1, the subsidiary has significant influence, and therefore the scope exemption applies. In A2, it doesn't, and therefore, I don't think you can't apply the scope exemption to sub A. You might be able to apply it at the parent level if the parent was a mutual or life company, for example. But you couldn't apply it at the subsidiary level. And I just think
we've just got to be what we're looking at here. In A2, you're talking about, if we're looking at the individual financial statements of the two subsidiaries, then they would be accounting for this as a financial instrument, and they would be able to use the fair value option for that, or it could be available for sale. as you say, each of the subsidiaries, you're presuming individually, doesn't have significant influence. Now that may be a big assumption to make, depending on the structure of the group. And equally, you might say, in A1's case, from the parents' point of view, having 45%, and it may have something else going on as well, but it may in fact be a subsidiary. So there are a number of variations we can make to the examples. The point of the examples was to try and provoke the thought in your mind as to different ways in which we're looking at this. But the question is really for the parent, in producing its consolidated financial statements, can it use the scope exemption to account for a part of its overall investment in this associate at fair value through profit and loss, using the venture capital investment fund, whatever, exemption? Or does it have to account for all of the investment using a single accounting policy? And that's really the focus of where we are on this. Okay.
Chairman, I also would support the staff recommendation. I do like Ruth's principle of trying to find some more things for the board to do. So if you are going to go that route, should the board be going down the route that says you can maintain the management intent, I think they will need to address what is an organisation, because otherwise you'll get the situation where divisions and things may be separable. So I think there'll be a sub-issue in there if you go that route.
I found it interesting that the last time this came up, the staff recommendation was there's only one possible answer, and therefore we shouldn't take it on the agenda. And now the staff recommendation is there are two possible answers, and therefore we shouldn't take it on the agenda.
If there were three,
how big does it have to be before we take it on the agenda? Part of what I wanted to get across is it seems like in a number of these papers we do find a lot of reasons to not take things on the agenda, and if you present us with any fact pattern, we can come up with a reason why we shouldn't address it. Seems to be what's happening here. I read the staff paper, and I quite frankly completely agree with the analysis that you could come to either answer, and I said that last time that we discussed it. Although in my head that actually led to either we ought to take it on and, you know, try to come up with what we think the right answer is, or maybe it's not material and therefore we shouldn't take it on. But we seem to believe that it is material, so I would vote to take it on the agenda.
Again, just for clarification, if we have two standards that have conflicting requirements, which is what happened some time ago when we dealt with IFRIC 10 on impairments and interim financial statements, then you couldn't comply with both. And to change one of them actually would have been a huge impact, as we're learning now in looking at impairments of financial instruments again, on a slightly wider basis than before. So it was appropriate for IFRIC tuition interpretation, which is then introducing a rule. That was all it was. Two choices, make one choice, because that's the most expeditious way of resolving the conflict. In this particular case, it is one standard that appears to lead you to two different, very different results. So the concern there is not giving an interpretation necessarily what the standard says, but if we can fix it by changing that one standard, which can be done more clearly than providing an interpretation that perhaps contrives to get a principle that it's being true to, and to explain that reason, then I think that's what the staff recommendation is. So just because there is a conflict, because there are two answers or three or four answers, doesn't mean to say that an interpretation is the best way of resolving the issue. Joanna?
Just to say, I support the staff's view in that I support also that I actually think there is a conflict within the standard, and therefore it is something that the board needs to sort out, and you cannot give an interpretation if there is a conflict. So I support this month's paper as opposed to 2 months ago, I'm afraid, Michael, and fully support that. But I actually think that we should be, if you like, I'm now moving on to the next bit on that basis, that we should be definitive in our recommendation, I guess it comes to the staff, to the board, and try to keep it as a quick fix. i.e. what the particular issue is, unless it goes with this whole review of 28 with consolidation. But I would very much keep it to the quick fix rather than expand it and effectively go with resolving the conflict.
Thank you, Lena. I think you're unlikely to get the quick fix, and that we are actually going to be taking the issue next month in June to look at IAS 28. We've got several issues that have come up in both IAS 31 revision as well as consolidation, where we've got conflict as a result of the way that IAS 28 is expressed. And simply having a quick fix is just going to put another bandage on it. So we're having a fundamental look to see whether or not we need to revise IAS 28. And this would not be a major project to revise it, but the constitutional amendments for those other projects. And this is one issue we'll add on as more evidence of the need to rethink IAS 28 this week.
My comment was simply...
You don't get to vote on it.
It's actually very easy to do. You just sort of say IAS 28 is withdrawn, and we know that's a quick fix. But whether there's enough momentum behind us to do that is another issue.
You could get that as a recommendation from us, right?
I generally agree with the idea to refer it to the board because it's clear that there is a conflict inside the standard, and I also have the feeling that this issue could be even more complex if you look at subsidiaries or other elements, because the analogy could be adopted. But in this sense, I think that the tentative agenda should be more clear in indicating the reasons. At the moment, it's only indicated that there are significant diversity in practice and that the IFIC has considered preference to refer. I believe that could be useful to indicate that there are some elements of conflict inside and therefore that this is the underlining of the decision.
Okay. I'm not getting a sense that anybody is disagreeing with the recommendation that we don't take this onto the agenda. Is that correct? Anybody think we should take it on? Okay. Well, you're entitled to your opinion. So the next question then is really the extent to which you want to be of assistance to the board in directing the board as to what sort of solution you think is the right solution. And there's been some concerns as to how far we go on that. Taking Luca's point, though, the agenda decision itself has to be something that is complete. We're not taking it on. We recommend it goes to the board because there's a conflict, and we think that the board can handle this more quickly than we can. That's the reason for the agenda decision. But if we can also provide some direction to the board, then that gives, I think, our constituents an early heads up on the thinking, not only of the IFRIC, but the thinking that might influence the way that the board directs any changes. Mindful, though, of Ken's warning that we don't want to get into a definitional project of defining what is an organization and to what does this IAS 28 exemption apply. Unfortunately, I would have to admit, as you'll bear remember as well, that we introduced this exemption without a definition. And we did that deliberately because there wasn't a definition we could point to, unlike a single jurisdiction, which can refer to its law that says that these entities then, if they exist, if they're registered, regulated, will be accounted for, may be accounted for in a particular way. On an international basis, we're just not sure that we could refer to that. And despite some suggestions in the early days from many of the Europeans that they wanted special accounting for investment-type companies, nobody's been able to come forward and help us to define what an investment-type company is. So I might be inclined to say that that's not something that at this meeting we even want to start to discuss, but rather those people that have been trying to use the exemption before will know the entity or the subset of the entity, which is really following through from part of the conceptual framework discussion as to what that entity is that might qualify for the exemption. That's probably something we can raised in an exposure draft and ask for more comments on. Ken, do you have a helpful suggestion?
Chairman, just on the general of where we would wish to see the board go, a point that hasn't, I think it was mentioned last time, I don't think it comes out in the paper, I didn't spot it, but of course the board has considered in the past the issue of treasury shares and where investment companies own their own shares as part of their portfolio and things, and said no, you know, you own your own shares, you own your own shares. And I do see a real analogy with this. Now I can see the other view as well, but I must admit I would draw that analogy and say once you're going down that route that says shares are shares are shares, that that would follow through. So that would be where I would go if we were going to make recommendations to the board.
Although we're not quite going that far, because the exemption only applies to investments in associates. So if in A1 the judgment was that in fact the thing was a subsidiary because of the 45% holdings and something else, then it wouldn't get the exemption, even if the individual, one of the companies, was entitled to the exemption in its individual financial statement, at the group level it wouldn't be. So perhaps one of the ways in which we might help the board is to say, well, what is the logical process you've got to go through in determining what it is you've got? And from the group level, do you add everything together to determine if it's a subsidiary, and if it's not, is it an associate? Have you got significant influence at the group level? And if not, then we don't have a problem. And to follow through then and say, well, if it is an associate at the group level, can it be in some way separated into the two parts where the exemption to account for the fair value of profit and loss applies to that part of the business that is operating as an investment fund or something else? I realize it's not going to answer the question of what to do with treasury shares, and I'm also very much aware of the concern in some countries that type of accounting brings in the presentation of the results.
I understand the distinction.
Despite the fact that I was the one that said maybe we should give some recommendations or some thoughts to that, on the basis that 38 is going to be opened up, by the sounds of it, quite extensively as a result of the consolidation project, I actually rescind that comment and think that it probably is because we don't know everything else that goes around it, we're probably better off not wasting our time, in inverted commas, trying to think of a solution in isolation.
I would agree if there is a larger project that is going to be undertaken, if there's been confusion that's been in existence for a while, if we give any kind of indication in our decision, it could lead people down a different path and it could add to the confusion instead of trying to clarify things. So I would hold off on providing any type of interpretation or recommendation.
Just a comment. I think an interpretation, a recommendation at this point would steer companies in a certain direction, which may not be the direction that IS-28 eventually takes. So if that is a larger project, I think if there is some consideration at any point given to a quick fix, then we may want to revisit. But on the assumption that it's a bigger project, I don't think we should say anything.
I agree with not making a recommendation to the board, but I would like in the agenda decision for us to refer to the scope exemption in IS-28, because we don't actually refer to it. And I think in the agenda decision we should talk about para 1 of IS-28, because that is what's giving rise to the problem. And that is not referred to at all in the agenda decision. So you could read the agenda decision without ever going to para 1 of IS-28 and not realise, well, why is there this problem? The problem is there because of the scope exemption. And we haven't actually referred to that in the agenda decision. So I would like us to say that very clearly, that that's where the issue comes from.
Any other comments?
One other suggestion about amending the agenda decision to specifically refer to the perceived conflict within the standards, so we can look at that. Do people also agree that there is a potential conflict between standards, in particular where 28 seems to imply one treatment and 27 implies common accounting policies, but then there's other places in the standards where, like two, where it says you could have different policies across the group. So it's a actually a bigger problem than just 28.
All right, Michael, just sign up then. We're not taking it on the... Oh, sorry, Gilbert.
I withdraw my preceding comment about referring to the board.
Thank you for your support. I concur with your views. The position is that we're, the IFRIC has decided not to take this onto the agenda and also not to recommend to the board in view of the fact that the board is looking at a broader project on amending IS-28, specifically what direction the board would be advised to take on this specific issue, but that would expand the agenda decision to reflect both the existence of the scope exclusion in 28 as perhaps the start of the problem, and also then the perceived conflict with IS-27 in requiring common accounting policies, and whether common accounting policies means that you can only choose one accounting policy for a thing, whereas IS-2 and other standards seem to imply that you can in fact have different methods of applying accounting to the same items in different parts of the group. Were there any other helpful comments that you would like from the IFRIC to enable you to pursue your decisions and recommendations to the board? Then I think we've earned a coffee break, 15 minutes. Part of the office procedures is to remove all the clocks in here, so we've got no idea what time it is. So I'm not going to tell you what time to come back, but look at your watch now. And if you're back in 14 minutes, you'll be on time. And if you're back in 16 minutes, you'll be late.